This is the Home Tech Podcast, show number 28 for June 2nd, 2011. I am your host, Jim Collison, broadcasting live on Ustream from the Average Guy Studios here in sunny Bellevue, Nebraska, and posted each week at theaverageguy.tv. You can contact the show podcast at theaverageguy.tv, and we often read those emails that we get from folks on the show. You can also follow the show posts that we put out just on my Twitter at Jay Collison, or you can find us on Facebook just by searching The Average Guy Network. I've got a full crew tonight. We've had a little trouble getting started, but I think we've gotten most of our audio problems worked out. A couple of the regulars and, of course, a couple of new guests on the show for the first time. Not really the first time, but first regular time. I'll introduce them here in just a second. First is Andrew Morris. Andrew's out of Melbourne and my right-hand man in Australia. Andrew, how are you this evening?
Pretty good, Jim. It's dark 30 still here this morning. We're just waiting for the sun to come up, and it's looking like it's going to be a sunny day in Melbourne.
Yeah, now we did, Andrew, do me a favor, cut your video too. I'm having audio. All of a sudden, the audio was dropping from you. But, Andrew, we woke you up early in the morning, at least early for your morning there. It's an early afternoon podcast here in the U.S. Sorry to get you out of bed and make you do a podcast first thing in the morning. But welcome to the show. Our website extraordinaire and the guy behind theaverageguy.tv speed as of late, Christian Johnson. Christian, welcome to the podcast tonight.
Hi, everyone. Thanks.
You're sounding good. You're down. You and your dad have switched computers, and you're down in his place, and he's in yours. Is that going to be all right?
Yep. Plus two monitors for me.
Nice. So you get a little bit of a hardware upgrade by going down to the basement.
Plus 48 inches.
But your computer's better than his, right?
Right, of course.
Okay, well, that's good.
Of course. And configuration-wise, I mean, hardware-wise, it's a bit debatable. But
oh, really?
We'll stick with configuration.
Maybe we'll have to have a showdown on the show. I only mention that because tonight we have Gary Johnson with us. He's better known as Christian's dad, and he has decided to join us tonight. Gary, how are you doing this evening?
Just fine, thanks.
It's good to have you. We had a few audio problems, like I said earlier, and get you on here. But it's good to have you. You kind of jumped on the podcast about a month or two ago when you guys were out doing a little vacation. And we actually made two podcasts out of one that night. And I thought it'd be a great idea to have you back. So welcome back to the show.
Pleasure to be here.
Like I said early in the show, if you want to contact us, you got ideas, things you'd like us to talk about, you can send us an email, podcast@theaverageguy.tv. We did move the show up this week. Typically, we're on 7 p.m. Central on Thursday nights. If you want to join us on Ustream, you can come out to theaverageguy.tv/live and join us. We had a couple out there tonight, so guys, thanks for making the jump in time. A couple things happened to me this week. If you've been following the show at all for any length of time, you know I've got a wedding coming up on Sunday. My oldest son gets married. We're actually going to broadcast that live on Ustream right here on this channel. So if you want to see what a wedding looks like, broadcast it live on Ustream. I feel a little bit like it's the royal wedding as of late with all these preparations and all the money that we're spending on getting it done. But so we moved the podcast early. I got family coming into town, and so we moved the podcast up to 4 tonight. But with all these things that are going on, one of the things that I'm doing for the wedding to save my kids a few bucks, I opted to DJ the wedding for him. Now, I have all my own portable sound equipment, PA work that I can take out and set up, and music and such. But this time I tried something different. I went ahead and I'm trying the Zune Pass trial. So for 14 days, you get to try the Zune Pass and get all unlimited music. Well, what I thought would be unlimited music, it turns out it's not necessarily unlimited music on the trial. Maybe if I pay for it and continue to keep it, it'll be different. Christian, do you have a Zune Pass? Do you guys have a Zune Pass there at your place?
No, pretty much Zune-less on this side. Surprisingly, I do stick with the Apple iPod for something like that.
And for music, you guys just purchase it as you go, or do you have any kind of subscription service?
Just purchase as we go, okay, if we just purchase.
Well,
go ahead, Gary.
We've got – has Christian talked about Subsonic before?
Mm-hmm.
We
talk about Subsonic a lot.
We've got all our music on the server, so I use my Android Evo 4G and just connect to the server for my music. And my daughter is the primary Apple card holder with the iTunes, so
yeah,
she downloads them and we put them on the server, and everybody
Buys much music.
Well, like I say, the popular thing around here is for any kind of birthday, graduation, whatever, everybody, you know, hands her the iTunes gift cards.
Yeah.
So she buys the music. And then the other nice thing is that by being very active, I'm always on the Subsonic support forums, and I've made a lot of, you know, a lot of connections with the guys on Subsonic, and they give me guest accounts on their servers. So right now I would say I have access to a half a dozen servers, and all together probably 3 terabytes worth of music.
So pretty much anything you would want to listen to, for the most part.
More than I could ever listen to in whatever time I've got left.
Yeah. Well, one of the things I've thought about is just going, just stop buying music and go complete subscription. I don't really... I do buy probably about an album a month, and that would pay for most of the subscription services, and then I'd get everything, right? And so I've been toying with the idea. Andrew, do you use any kind of subscription or music service? You just buy music as you go as well?
We tend to buy it or download it as we need it, yeah.
Okay. So still pretty traditional.
Very much on demand, yeah.
Yeah. Well, so I went with Zune. We've talked about that before. The Zune Pass seems to be one of the more known subscription services. I think I looked at Rhapsody, Yahoo Music. There's a few other ones out there that are subscription as well, but Zune seemed to be the easiest one for me, and they had a 14-day trial. So I went out, signed up for it. I did have to put a credit card number in, but if I cancel before the 14 days, hopefully this isn't an... And the older guys will get this reference. Hopefully this isn't the Columbia Records deal of of music, right?
How about Book of the Club? Yeah.
Yeah, whatever. Fill that in, right? But so for 14 days, it's all free. And so I went out and started downloading. I probably put together about 3.5-4 hours worth of music for the wedding. And yeah, I was pretty surprised at how hard it was, actually, to be honest with you. Not just the music, picking the music, but the Zune service didn't always work well for me. So I would go out and I'd find a song and I'd click on it to play, and a little yellow exclamation point would pop up and it would just move down to the next song. Like, it was unavailable. I'm like, hey, wait a minute. I don't want the next song. I want this song. So I click on it again. And I found sometimes I'd have to click on it 3 or 4 or 5 times to actually get it to play. And then when I went to download it, same kind of deal. I'd click download, it'd say pending, it'd go back to download. I'd click it again, it'd go pending, go back to download. Now, I don't know if that was because I was on a laptop that had a slow, you know, I was on a wireless. You know, we just know how good wireless stuff is, right, Gary, and making things work. But I was on a wireless laptop connecting, you know, a pretty good connection. I was right above it in the house, so I don't think it was the connection, but... More often than not, the service didn't work for me, or I'd have to click on it multiple times. Of course, if it hadn't been free, I might have given up on it at that point. I mean, I might have expected a greater service level on it from that point. But I was really surprised. It was not as the software, which has been touted by the folks that I kind of hang out with as being really good music, you know, as a music server or music player, whatever you want to call it on your PC, an iTunes replacement, so to speak, didn't real work real well for me. So I was a little disappointed in that in the end.
Maybe Christian can find it. I don't remember what it was now, but I was using a very similar service, and maybe if you guys remember the popular ones, but it worked really well, and I gave it up after the trial period, but only because I had so much music on Subsonic. But that this problem you're having with Zune almost sounds like the same type of thing I sometimes get with the Technic downloads. They just stop in the middle, and then you have to hit resume to get the download to go again. But that other service I tried, and gosh, I wish I could. It's kind of orangey when you pull it up. But I never had any trouble with that. You could search all kinds of stuff and bring up scads of music and just listen online. But and I think the subscription price was like $3.99 a month or something.
That's pretty reasonable. Yeah, Zune is $14.99, and then you get 10 free songs a month. So if you're purchasing, it's kind of a nice hybrid solution in that you still get to purchase music, and at some point, if you ever cut off the subscription, you don't feel like you need it anymore. you do get to keep the 10 songs that you purchase.
Yeah, it still sounds way expensive compared to some of the other stuff I've been on, and I'll make a note to look that up, which one it was that I was on. But I've been on some that are like dead. They're dirt cheap and they work really great.
Yeah. Well, it wasn't the greatest experience for me. I'll be honest. I probably wouldn't go back and use the service with the problems I had. I eventually got the music that I needed. And I wasn't, you know, I kind of committed to it for this wedding, so I wasn't going to go back and stop at that point. But in the end, you know, again, I'd have to do a little more troubleshooting. I don't know if it was Microsoft servers or what, but boy, the Zune Pass was not as attractive at the end of the of it than it was getting going. I also, go ahead, Gary.
You do, of course, are aware of the fact that Microsoft just bought Skype. So
yeah,
we may have some problems in the future.
I know Skype had some issues before. I hope they don't magnify it. Owned by Microsoft. One of the other things I kind of pulled out of the closet and blew the dust off of, and something I hadn't used from a software perspective, was Oracle's VirtualBox. And VirtualBox came to Oracle via the Sun acquisition back last year. And it was something I've been using when we were testing the Windows Home servers. They were still in their beta form. Very, very handy piece of software to be able to put, you know, a test box up on my PC very, very quickly, do some testing, and then tear it down just as equally as quick. I didn't need the hardware for that. Gary, do you guys, in your environment, from a test, from a testing standpoint, do you guys use... or do you use any kind of VM or virtualization for testing?
Yeah, I've got Hyper-V running on our Server 08 box, and that's what I use to... I run an instance of Windows Home Server 2011 in 2 gigs of RAM, and that's what I use to host our public subsonic server. So I kind of isolated that server from the rest of the network on the virtual machine. And that's what's open to the public for guest passes that I post on the subsonic forums for people that want to, you know, go on to my site to see. There's a lot of troubleshooting involved. So sure. I a lot of times show them things that are working on my site and help them, you know, debug their programs. But Christian, you use some other virtual Sun, is it?
Yeah, I'm using the Sun VirtualBox. I particularly like it over some of the other solutions because it's one of the only virtual machines that will natively support 3D video acceleration. So your experience is much more fluid compared to like built-in XP mode in Windows 7 and even compared to VMware Player. This is just way faster because you can dedicate up to 128 megabits on a shared video card that is actually doing 3D hardware acceleration, and they do have some limited OpenGL and Direct3D support, but none of the other products come close to the level of video capability this thing has, which makes your overall using the desktop experience much faster.
You know, Christian, it's one of the easiest pieces of virtualization software I've found to use. It you know, for an average guy like me, average tech guy, let's say, because you're probably not going to pull somebody off the street and have them do a VM. But for the average tech guy, you don't have to know a lot about VM or setups. It's an EXE install. It runs basically on anything you can think of. I mean, any OS that's out there, it will run on top of, and it will run just about any OS virtually on top of any OS. I mean, it's very flexible and very usable from that standpoint. So you can do the setup and get a virtual machine running very, very quickly. Andrew, what's your preference from virtualization?
I played around a little bit with VirtualBox. I mean, we're a VMware shop, so it's nice to be able to pick up a VMware virtual machine and just drop it into an ESX farm. Or likewise, I use VMware Player and Workstation at home. On my day-to-day laptop, I use the Microsoft XP mode, which is the Windows 7 variant of Virtual PC.
Right.
That has the challenge where it doesn't really like running a server operating system that much. But I live in that because some of our corporate tools won't run on Windows 7, so I've got to run them on XP still.
Okay.
So you get full integration and, you know, integrated mouse, so you can click from one window to the other without having to double click to get focus, which is, you know,
that is kind of nice. Yeah.
It's only a small thing, but I reckon it's a major pain to have to click in a window and then click again to make your mouse do what you want it to do.
Yeah, and that is the case in VirtualBox. You also have to hold a control key to get your mouse out of
okay,
that box.
Yeah. But, I mean, hey, the price is right, and it performs pretty well.
I've loved VirtualBox. It's somebody mentioned in chat, Vinyl Freaks out there, he'd asked me, is it free? And it's absolutely free, at least at this point. I don't think Oracle has any intention to take OpenOffice or VirtualBox and make them paid services at this point. I fairly tight in the Oracle community, and I haven't heard any of those things come out of that. So that's a good sign at this point. One of the other nice things that they do update VirtualBox quite frequently with new features. One of the newest features that I just noticed this morning when I was doing some testing had to do with running a particular feature on the 64-bit version. And the error was interesting because it said, not supported in this version of VirtualBox. It's coming in the next version. That's what it said in the error box. I thought, well, that's okay. That's kind of interesting that they would, you know, that they would be bold enough to say it's coming in the next version. Andrew, I cut you off. What were you going to say?
One of the nice things about Oracle having picked up OpenOffice and VirtualBox, I think, is because of their open source roots, I think they will keep it that way. Because if you look at Oracle, you know, they've got a fair whack of product suite now that has never been paid for. You know, your Java runtime, and now VirtualBox and OpenOffice. So,
yeah,
I think the precedent's been pretty well set that they need to leave it there too.
Yeah, I hope so. I hope they make the decision to continue to leave those open and to leave them free. I don't think people would pay for them, to be honest with you. They've been free long enough that, and they're not embedded in enough things that people are going to start paying for them. So, and I don't know. I mean, there's probably 5 people in the U.S. who use OpenOffice. So, you know.
Yeah, well, OpenOffice has had the fork come out of it as well, which is called, I think, LibreOffice. So they've got a competitor that's based on the same code now as well. So when Oracle picked up OpenOffice, I think Sun picked them up and then Oracle picked them up with the Sun acquisition.
Right.
But the code forked at that time, and so there's a competitor that's almost on exactly the same code base.
Right.
So strategically, they'd be mad to do that, I think.
Well, hopefully, from a open standard standpoint, they'll just continue to leave them that way. Gary, how much open software, open source software, do you kind of use in your? You've got a pretty intense home network there. Do you use much open software in what you're doing?
We will if we find stuff that's halfway decent. The biggest bargain I think in the world is a TechNet subscription.
Yeah.
You know, it just gives you. Like right now, I think it used to be 10 licenses per product. Now they dropped it to 5. But even so, none of the product keys expire. So, you know, you can install it on several machines and they don't give you a problem at all. So, I mean, my whole home is up to date with the latest versions of all the Microsoft products. Costs us $249 a year. I mean, how can you go wrong with that? I mean, you know, everybody's running Windows 7 Ultimate, Office 2010 Ultimate. So our need for open source is limited, but, you know, like Subsonic is open source. And,
right.
And we absolutely love that. And anytime I find I know we've got open source stuff. In fact, I just sent Christian a link to a web photo album that, is all open source that I want him to look at for integrating into our websites. And I actually sent the link to the developer for Subsonic because I want him to include a photo library into Subsonic. So I sent him that link to give him some ideas to, you know, hopefully incorporate something similar. But I'm not opposed to open source as long as, number one, it's not a suspect product. You know, I mean, there's so much stuff out there that's insidious. Christian's going to talk a little bit about some of it coming up, but I'm really careful about what I download and what I install. I just can't afford to get you know, really infected with something that I'm not sure what it is and where it came from and whether or not it's safe to download it. So we generally, I try to stick to, you know, sites that are known to screen the software pretty well before you download it, like CNET or someplace like, you know, someplace reputable. Make sure you're not getting something that's going to really bog you all up.
Yeah, I don't know about you guys, but I'll be honest. I don't know if I've downloaded just like a regular piece of software, you know, that I would even consider suspect in the last couple years. I mean, I'm like you, Gary. I get all my software from TechNet from a Microsoft standpoint. I use a few tools like VirtualBox. I'm trying to think, maybe like TeamViewer. That, you know, the rest of it comes from various sources. I don't know. It's just, it's weird. There was a time when software was everywhere, and now you go into Best Buy and it's one row, right?
Yeah.
It's barely even that. It's half of that's Microsoft OS stuff that they've spread around to make it look bigger than it is. It just doesn't seem like, and of course the phone market now is that wild, wild west.
Oh, absolutely. I think, you know, the Android market is, and the iPhone market is really where most of the software development's taking place. But, I think we're hitting, my experience has been that the industry and the consumer tend to run in cycles. And I think we're at the end of a cycle where I think that, at least I know I am, where we're reaching a point of saturation where we actually have more hardware and software than we know what to do with.
Yeah.
And we're now at a point where we're really working on implementing what we have, refining what we have, debugging it, and trying to, you know, get ourselves to a level of proficiency where, yeah, you know, I can help you with Active Directory, I can help you with SharePoint, I can help you with some of the more of these difficult technologies, but very powerful technologies if in fact you master them. So
right.
I don't need much software or really much hardware at this point. I need to master what I have.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's a great point. I think we are to that point. It's more about refining than it is about new software in there. And you know, we're all a bunch of Windows Home Server users. And of course, they have a new version of that as well. And so it's about kind of incorporating in that new software, figuring out what features and pieces are going to work for us, and then making that work on some hardware, right? I mean,
yeah, I'm a big proponent, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. And unfortunately, we broke our Windows Home Server version 1 when we tried a hardware upgrade. I don't know how much Christian told you about that. So that's what propelled us into Server 2011. But I still kind of wish my old Windows Home Server version 1, just we had it debugged. We had it running smooth as glass. It was rock solid. It never failed. It was on 24/7. We figured out how to expand the C drive from the 20 gig limit. We had it up to 250. We were just golden. And then I decided I'd upgrade the hardware underneath the software.
Oh, boy.
Oh, big mistake.
Ouch. Yeah. that ended your day.
Yeah. Well, it was just going from an AMD platform to an AMD platform, but it was a different chipset and it just didn't do well.
Well, you're on 2011 now though, right?
Yeah. And it works well and it's fine, but you've got to be much more active in your hard drive management. I was finding that I was filling up the drives too fast, and so I had to take the server folders and the backups and split them onto different drives in order to get enough room for all of them to operate. So it's much more complicated and it takes a lot more intervention to utilize your resources wisely.
Yeah, we talk a lot about that on the Home Server Show. And so if you don't know what we're talking about, or you haven't experienced a home server, check that out, homeservershow.com. That will get you in there and kind of figuring out what a home server is. Andrew, I want to throw it over to you. You've got a topic on RSS, and that certainly is one of those technologies that has been around a long time, but us podcasters and people who listen to podcasts use it a lot. I'm not sure everybody else does. Why don't you talk a little bit about it?
Yeah, so RSS is basically syndication of blog feeds as a general rule. You can also syndicate audio, but from my perspective, I don't do that. I use iTunes for my syndication of audio feeds for podcasts and the like. One of the reasons that I thought I'd bring this up, I do most of my RSS syndication at the moment from within Outlook, because I live inside Outlook most days. One of the challenges I find is because I'm using it within my corporate instance of Outlook, we have mailbox limits. So if I decide I want to keep a bunch of stuff, then to refer back to at a later date. Oh, hang on, Jim. How's that?
Yeah, I'm just getting a weird, deep humming background noise from you. I think that's better. Keep going.
Okay. I'll kill my video off.
There you go.
So, because I live in Outlook and we have a 200 meg mailbox limit, I'm looking at the moment to move my RSS catcher off to a third party product and take it out of Outlook and, you know, free up 10-20 meg worth of my mailbox. But when you start looking out there, there's just not a lot of really nice, smooth RSS readers that come close to the experience you get within Outlook. I mean, you can take it to the cloud and use something like Google Reader, and then you can interface to that using it's a product called Feed Demon, and I've had a play with another one called RSS Bandit. Although the name of that's a bit hit and miss if you rattle it off quickly, and I'm at a bit of a loss as to where to go with my next RSS reader, because I don't really like the Google interface for it.
It is a little difficult. Christian, what from an RSS standpoint, what do you use?
I normally actually I'm pretty old school with RSS. I use either the desktop gadget, Rain Meter, or I just go right in the browser and read the RSS version so that I don't have to see all the others clutter on the site.
And what do you use from a podcast catcher standpoint?
Podcast catching, yeah. I'm not really doing, because between iTunes auto downloading it and Subsonic auto catching them, there's no need to have one running on the desktop.
Yeah, so you're just using iTunes and Subsonic to bring your podcasts to a place where you can listen to them.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, Subsonic, you can program Subsonic to capture all the podcasts and download them automatically, and then, you know, you can access them from your phone.
Yeah, Andrew. What? So the 200 gig limit is being enforced by your local
employer.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah, and you feel like that's not enough for what you're downloading into your RSS feeds?
I think it's more so when you get a bit slack on keeping up to date with what comes through your feed stream, you end up blowing out your corporate mailbox with stuff that isn't related to work.
Yeah.
So I'm trying to separate a bit of work and a bit of my work and personal stuff, which I know is always a challenge when you live in a corporate world, is to try and get that delineation. But I'm trying to make that break.
Well, and as a podcaster, RSS is everything, because that's how we send our feeds out, right, for the podcast. So
yeah.
I always encourage people, you know, you know, somebody will say, "Oh, hey, I listened to your show and it was great." And then I'll say, "Oh, it's great. So, are you downloading it?" And they're like, "Oh, I can download it," you know, or you know, can you get it through? Are you getting it through iTunes? Oh, you can get that through iTunes. There, I don't think the average person is really caught on, for the most part, in that podcast can be subscribed to and can be downloaded into a feed reader of some type, where you can automatically get them and aggregate them. I still think that's a fairly foreign concept. Now, I am noticing a lot of apps on phones coming out that are catering towards that, and you might get a specific podcast network might build an app just for their podcast that make it easy to download their podcast and listen to them. Andrew, of what you get in your reader, how much of it is text and how much of it is audio?
All of it's text.
Okay.
So for audio, I use iTunes, just because every podcast I listen to, and I know we publish into iTunes as well.
Right.
I figure
I'll listen via an iPod, and I don't want to go through the hassle of downloading it, converting it, and then putting it into the, or putting it onto the iPad manually,
right.
iPod manually.
Right.
And part of that's just me being lazy.
Yeah. Well, it's a hassle, I'll admit. And maybe Subsonic makes it easy for you guys, Gary and Christian. But I know for most people, it's a hassle to, from a podcasting standpoint, to manage those podcasts, download them, manage them, delete them, you know what you've listened to, know what you haven't listened to. That can be a hassle for some folks. I guess Subsonic makes that pretty easy.
Oh, yeah. It downloads them in order, and you got your whole library. And, you know, no, I don't think there's any facility for marking them as read, but I don't really need it. I mean, I know which ones I listen, you know, what number I listened to last. So it's just a question of which number do I want to listen to next. It's not that I don't get that technical with it, but it works great, and it's real easy. And once you've set it up, it's all done. It's, you know, so anytime you want to listen to a podcast from any source, you just log into Subsonic. You go to your podcast library. You pull up the source you want and pull up the session that you want. And like I say, you can listen to it right online. You can download it to your phone. You can listen to it over 3G on your phone. If you're driving in your car, you can put your Android player in the holder on the dashboard, set up your Bluetooth to connect to the stereo in the car, and you can listen to your podcast while you're driving. I mean, it's just a wonderful way for a ton of flexibility with any kind of recorded media.
Right. Yeah. And I'll that Bluetooth sometimes doesn't always work right, but yeah, that is a nice way to do it for sure.
Is that a dig on my headset?
I was just kidding. Yeah. No, I have had some problems where it doesn't always connect right, and it doesn't always work the first time, or you know, you come out of the car and it. I've even had my Bluetooth not disconnect from the car's receiver in my office because they're close, and so my phone will ring and it's ringing in the car.
In the car.
Yeah. I'm like, why is how come I'm not hearing this or whatever? So
yeah.
Christian,
that can happen.
Christian, you came across some breaking news. We're not really a breaking news podcast, but it's worth talking about. What'd you come across?
Yeah, so we just talked about 2-3 weeks ago how Sony had been hacked on their PlayStation network and were down for 2 weeks. And it looks like another department was just taken down. The Sony picture department just has been hacked yet again by Lulz Security. Where the article goes into detail talking about how over 1 million users have had personal information stolen, and it was all their passwords were in plain text again. So yet again, Sony is storing this sensitive data in plain text file format, and then they just come around with a simple SQL injection and bam, most of the stuff that they have so-called security is now taken apart. So if you look at the new front page on Engadget, you're going to see Sony Pictures hacked by Lulz Security, and you'll see the picture that says Lulzsec, and it's an entire picture in ASCII characters, and it's just unbelievable.
They can't get a break, can they?
No. Although they deserve it if they're dumb enough to be storing stuff in plain text file format on an SQL server instead of calculating a hash.
True, huh? And I mean, when you consider how long they've taken their various networks down for after the PlayStation network attack, it's pretty bad, isn't it?
Yeah, and yet alone the fact that it's an SQL injection attack, you know? That's just lousy coding for a network that big.
Yeah, and you would think a corporation like Sony would have like enough resources to hire people that would actually know how to prevent that.
You would think, wouldn't you?
You'd hope.
Wouldn't you? Yeah.
Like I say, it's just you just sit here and shake your head and just go, whoa, you know, what are these people thinking, or are they? It doesn't make any sense. Doesn't make any sense at all.
Well, more news on that, I'm sure, will come out. Now, the people who hacked that, Christian, that's a security firm, right? That's not just some random hacker?
No, this is a group of people called Lulz Security that...
That's my cell phone down there.
That's awesome.
Called, Yeah, it's called Lull Security, and I'm not sure what kind of legitimate company they are, but apparently they're one that could be looking at some time. But and again, even this went over a lot of people too, but the Sony BMG headquarters in Greece were hacked on May 23rd, so that was after the PlayStation Nightmare 2, and again, that was another SQL injection.
Yeah. Well, it's crazy what's going on out there. Certainly, Sony has taken it on the chin from a security standpoint.
And Lull Security is not not something to kind of dismiss, because I know they've taken down the Fox network before. They've taken down all sorts of top-notch companies. So,
all right. Well, good catch, Christian. It's interesting, as you were talking about this, we've had so many audio problems in this podcast. So if you're the first time you're listening to the Home Tech podcast, typically we don't, but for whatever reason tonight, we've had all kinds of audio problems. Andrew's buzzing in the background. We got a little pitch coming at Christian, and phones are ringing and other stuff's happening. But Christian, when you were talking about that, I got this call from Skype coming to me from their online help. And it was like, you know, if you answer this, you're going to put your other call on hold. And of course, I declined it. But I've never gotten a call. I've never gotten online help. I assume that's Skype's online help.
No, it's Microsoft.
Uh-oh. Yeah,
I reckon that sounds like spam to me.
Well, yeah, it's the contact is called. It's online help. And maybe it's someone spoofing. They're here in the U.S., or at least that's what they're touting they are. It was just kind of interesting that I got this random call while in the middle of having all these Skype issues. So it's really not Skype's fault, the issues we've had tonight. But
yeah.
Anyways, kind of crazy. Well,
and
go ahead.
Really quick. This is off Lull Security's website. They just posted a message with the crazy ASCII art in a full text document. It says, "Greetings, folks. We're LulzSec, and welcome to Sonage. Enclosed, you will find various collections of data stolen from internal Sony networks and websites, all of which we accessed easily and without the need for outside support or money. We recently broke into Sony Pictures and compromised over 1 million users' personal information, including passwords, email addresses, home addresses, date of birth, and all Sony opt-in data associated with their accounts. Among other things, we also compromised all admin details of Sony Pictures, along with 75,000 music codes and 3.5 million music coupons.
Wow.
Due to a lack of resource on our part, we were unable to fully copy all of this information. However, we have samples for you in our files to prove its authenticity. In theory, we could have taken every last bit of info, but it would have taken several more weeks. Our goal here is not to come across as master hackers, hence we are about to reveal SonyPictures.com is owned by a very simple SQL injection, one of the most primitive and common vulnerabilities. As we should all know by now, from a single SQL injection, we accessed everything. Why do you put such faith in a company that allows itself to become open to these simple attacks?" So it kind of talks about how it's an embarrassment to Sony, and how they're, as a result, it's also part of their Sony BMG hacks, and that they're going to be following this, kind of keeping people updated on Twitter.
Well, do you ever trust, are you ever going to give Sony any bit of your information again?
Nope.
No. I can't imagine that's a great idea at this point. Although they'll probably spend millions to lock their networks down, but nobody will ever trust them again.
Yep. Well, it brings up a great point, and I'm really almost all my online transactions I do through PayPal, for the simple fact that it masks the underlying transaction to, you know, either a credit card or my bank debit card. I just like that extra layer of insulation, and God forbid PayPal ever gets hacked, but at least there's only one point of vulnerability. And if PayPal got hacked and those underlying accounts got cracked, well, then probably you would have enough time to, you know, do some intervention to prevent any kind of fraud on your individual accounts. But, yeah, I think it's really important when you're giving out information that you use something like a PayPal that doesn't give every online business that you do any transactions with all your detailed information. It's much
right.
better.
Right. Yeah, it's got to be careful about what you put out there for sure.
The less, the better.
Yeah. Christian, why don't you take a second while you're doing that? Why don't you take a second and roll through Christian's Corner with what you got to update with us with?
All right. So welcome to Christian's Corner yet again, back for another week of more exciting and crazy things that you would never imagine possible. First thing on the news is our speed tip of the week. It's kind of a double header this week because there's two different areas we're going to be covering for Windows 7 performance. The first being a memory optimization tweak to ensure that Windows 7 and actually Windows XP and Windows Vista are properly prefetching all of your information into your memory. So this is a tweak called Enable Prefetcher. It's a regular option within the Windows Registry Editor, and there are three different levels of options you can call together. One enables for application only, two enables for boot only, and three enables it for both. Three has no effect at all, but the optimal setting is three because that will enable both your boot caching and your application caching. Most modern computers that are configured correctly will have it automatically set to three, but you want to go into that registry value and make sure that it is set to three. HK local machine system, current control set, control, session manager, memory management, and prefetch parameters, which of course will all be in the show notes so you can quickly get to it. And the second component of the speed tip of the week is a TCP optimizer, which was really popular back during the Windows XP days because Windows XP didn't have any native controls for optimizing the bandwidth on your network and configuring your network cards. And now even with Windows 7 having some of that built-in tweaking, it is still can be further tweaked. So their latest version, version 3.07, has special support for Windows 7. And primarily what it's going to probably be the biggest tweak for you is that it will enable what's called maximum amount of concurrent connections, whereas normally a normal setting for Internet Explorer is that you can only download one object at a time. And part of the auto optimization process of the TCP tweaker is that it will make it so that you can have at least 10 or more concurrent download connections. So you're getting 10 downloads at once instead of one. Now, it gets to a point where you can only set the value so high and then it becomes useless. But normally the TCP optimizer, there is an option that will enable you to simply hit optimize for this computer now, and that will enable you to give a quick reboot, and then a network card will be tuned for maximum amount of downloads and connections, as well as other various internet caches and tweaks. And that is normally good to check, because especially if you're back in XP or a different operating system, you can see noticeable differences if you run a speed test on that computer, if the computer wasn't really properly configured for the maximum network capacity.
So is that based on your current network connection, or is it based on the machine itself and the available bandwidth coming out of the interface?
Right. Well, what it does is there's a little slider, and you select the bandwidth that you know you're getting from your cable provider. So if I was getting 20 megabytes, that's what I would set it to on the slider. And then you hit optimize, and it'll optimize and set all the settings it needs to based on what internet speed you gave it.
Okay, and so you'd test that using like a speedtest.net or something like that?
Right, something like Speakeasy.
Yeah, so you'd see a real performance change for your for the changes to the interface.
It can depend on how far off your original settings are, but the biggest tweak is the default receive window. It'll optimize that for you. So back in the old days of XP, I always used to use this site, and it was dramatic, the change that you would get. So I'm going to take a look at what they've done new, but speedguide.net has always been a great source for tuning tips.
That's an excellent one, that one.
Yeah, because I think they were a bit stinted when Windows 7 had some of that auto bandwidth optimization built into the core runtime of the internet services, but this new version seems to do some additional stuff and additionally cover the stuff that may not be configured correctly the first time around. Is part of that
because they protect the they try to protect the stack a bit more in Windows 7 to stop it having the ability to become a viral distribution point or something similar?
I don't think it's really much as a security concern as much as that when XP came out, there was really no API or framework built into the OS to determine how much bandwidth was coming in on the network card and what settings you should have. XP always had, I think, one download. You could only have one download going on at a time when loading a page or rendering it. And it was very limited and pre-kind of configured for a dumb connection. And obviously now the bandwidth availability has changed dramatically. So when Windows Vista and 7 came out, there's a part of the Windows 7 kernel auto sets the MTU and some other internet things that get you kind of in a ballpark area. But like I say, the speed guide speed tweaker utility just takes it to a new level.
Yeah. Okay. Oh, cool. So that's a really handy one. That.
Yep. Definitely.
It's probably more useful to you guys. Our bandwidth out here is very limited. So I mean, the fastest connection you can get in Australia is around about 20-30 megabit per second. Whereas I think you guys, on your Fios, you can take that up to 100 megabit per second, can't you?
Right, yeah, if you pay a good price for it. But yeah, you can easily get up to 100 on a good T1 line coming out of Verizon. And even on residential, you can get up there. So
that's incredible. That's we dream about that sort of bandwidth out here.
All right. But I mean, even if you're on a very slow connection, so say 1 megabit per second, I mean, the TCP optimizer will optimize that cache in those settings for that kind of connection, which if you're optimizing for a 40 megabit connection and you're on a 2 megabit connection, you're actually going to have performance degradation. So again, this really tunes it for what your bandwidth is and what your capability, your network card is, which is why it works so well.
Yeah, I would say that, Andrew, it's probably more important to be properly tuned on a lower bandwidth connection than it is on a high bandwidth connection, because you know, if you've got a 50 mega 50 megabit down connection and it's not tuned to 100%, you're still going to get rocking download speed. But if you've got a low speed connection, it's really important that you're getting the most out of it.
Yeah, that makes sense. Does this assume that you're directly connected to your broadband connection?
Well, you select your whatever wireless NIC or network card you want to configure it for.
Yeah. Okay. Because I'm thinking, how do you take into account your router and your interface device?
Well, as long as you know yourself what your bandwidth is from your ISP. Because it's tweaking it for what your ISP is giving you. It doesn't really matter what your router is configured for.
Yeah. Once you give it the theoretical limit of the ISP's connection, then it tunes all the settings on the NIC to maximize for that theoretical bandwidth.
Yep. Okay. Oh, nice. That's awesome.
So, Christian, if I run this optimizer on the network right now, will I just kill the podcast?
Well, no, it'll actually, you'll save changes and then it'll ask you for a reboot.
Oh, okay. All right.
That would kill the podcast.
Yeah, that would, a reboot. Well, it would kill me. I would leave the podcast. Yeah. The server would keep the connection going and you guys could keep talking.
We would do that.
You would. I know you would. I just proved that. All right. So. Christian, what else you got for us?
moving into the deal of the week, this was something we purchased for a new box we're getting ready to put together. The Seasonic X Series fanless power supply, available on Newegg, puts out 400 watts fanless, so it's quiet, and it's also gold certified. And for $140 with free shipping, it's a pretty nice deal.
And even better, it's a totally modular, so you don't have to have any wires in there that you don't need. The connector is completely clean, so you know you only put in the connections that you need. So
is that is it expensive because it's fanless?
Yes, okay. It is expensive, but it's wireless and it's modular and it's fanless, and it's got pretty good specs on it. So that's going into our HTPC box that we've already got built, but it's in a tower case and it's got too many fans in it, and it's a little noisy for being next to the television. So I ordered a Lee and Lee aluminum HTPC case with two 40 millimeter fans in the back, and we'll put the fanless in there and a Zalman CPU cooler in it, and hopefully we won't even hear it when it boots up.
Yeah, that's great. We'll pair that with a SSD drive and an Atom processor.
That's in my segment coming up.
All right. We better get to that quick here. What else you got, Christian?
All right. So running through the last part is something that we ran into this week, and it kind of drove us crazy. And no one really knows about it, and I'd be surprised if you guys knew about it, because it was sure a surprise for us, is that in the latest version of Skype 5.3, when you install it, you'll notice after your reboot and you're back in the new version, if you go to your start menu, you'll see something called Easy Go. And you'll look in your start menu and you'll say, I wonder what this Easy Go could be. And it turns out Skype is now automatically installing a game console called Easy Go, where there's no uninstaller available, and it never asks you whether or not you want to install it in the first place. It's just kind of there now. So you have to go through registry magic and removing it from Skype in order to get it to detach from your system. And not even using it or being aware of it, it was taking up 70 megabits of RAM.
Easy Go, huh?
Yep. Yeah, I'm not positive, but I think I read that since they got some complaints that they're now offering that. It's something you have to click to accept. Right. But I don't honestly remember if I did that or if it just did it to me, but it ended up on my system, and it was.
Well, I just upgraded to 5.3 last week, and I don't see it. So I wonder if that's changed since.
You recall whether or not seeing an option?
I pretty much check everything off, like no.
Yeah.
With Skype, so I could have just blown through it. But that'll be interesting to get some feedback from people if anybody else has seen.
I saw it the other day on my wife's computer.
Okay.
But it did have an uninstall of this. This link you've sent it, this forum post talks about it not having an uninstaller, but I did find one.
Okay. Did you find one in Windows, or did you find you have to go somewhere else to get it installed?
No, in Add Remove programs, it was in there.
All right. Well, that's an interesting, that's an interesting thing. If that's certainly that's a pre Microsoft thing.
It was just after. Well. Huh? It was probably developed before Microsoft took over, but it didn't roll out until Microsoft took over.
Okay.
I think it was just after.
Yeah, because I looked at it and I thought, what is that?
And Christian, you said it's a game platform?
Yeah. Are you,
it's like a,
are you familiar with the Taligent, I think it is, that HP puts out? Same type of thing.
Okay.
Yeah, all it's right. Like Wild Tangent and that kind of stuff.
Yeah, Wild Tangent.
All right. I think the lesson there is just be careful. Well, one, if they don't give you the choice, you're screwed. But if they do give you the choice, watch what they give you when you're installing stuff. We've said this before. Just actually read. Take a second and read the stuff. You don't have to read the whole EULA. But well, you should, but you don't have to. But just watch what you check, what's pre-checked for you when you're installing stuff, because you'll get toolbars and all kinds of crap, right, that you just don't need. So, all right.
Yep.
Good catch, Christian.
Yep, and finally, I am on the Lull Security website, and just looking at it, seems like they started around July 5th, and here's the list of what they have gotten so far. They got X Factor back in July. In October, they got the Fox.com sales databases. In May 15th, they got a UK ATM database. The 23rd, they got Sony Music. And this was something I didn't realize was a connection to, was they're the same company responsible, well, not company, but they're the same group that are responsible for the PBS fake article, the Tupac. The Tupac is still alive in New Zealand. That was Lulz Security, and they not only put that article there, but they got their internal host database list, staffers database, authors database, press room users database, stations database, and MySQL users database. So they had a home run right there.
Wow.
But yeah, I didn't even realize that they were connected to the same people who did the Sony work.
Hacking away.
Yeah.
Well, got to be careful what you give to Sony these days.
Yep.
RIP, Sony. It was nice having you on the internet.
Yeah.
It was nice. Gary, you brought some stuff to talk about. What do you got for us?
I did. I got a ton. So I'll try and run through it as quick as I can. And basically, being an old salt and having been around for playing this game since 1983, I figured I'd share my view of the big picture of where we're heading, where we are, and where we're going down the road. So,
all right, we'll jump in and contradict you every chance we get.
Absolutely.
All right.
I think the most recent development today is a change in what we would call the concept of convergence. And so I'm going to review what basically is the old convergence picture, and that was the integration of the computer into home entertainment and multimedia and cable television. And that's basically done now that you have the Seton tuner card available, which allows you to hook up to your digital cable networks with four internal tuners. It allows you to watch live TV and to record three other channels at the same time. And also, in addition, Silicon Dust has just announced that they're taking pre-orders on Newegg right now for the HD Prime series. There's two of them. One uses three tuners. The other one uses six tuners. But the six-tuner model is basically two three-tuners kind of glued together. If you go to the six-tuner model, you would need two cables going to the device, and you would need two M cards to decode the transmission from the cable company. So for all intents and purposes, we're going to probably eventually go with the three-tuner model. And what that does is that sits on your network, and any Windows 7 computer that has a media center in it can tap one of those tuners and take it and utilize it as a local tuner on Windows Media Center on the desktop. So we'll have the Seton card in the HTPC in the family room, which will be the primary DVR recorder, and then we'll put the Silicon Dust on the network with three tuners so that anybody that wants to watch live TV on their local workstation will have a tuner available for Windows 7.
And those cards are just dynamite. I don't even know how I live without them. I have a dual tuner, and it's just fantastic. I mean, it's crazy good. And its integration with Windows Media Center is just – it's amazing. I mean, it's everything you've ever wanted in a TV application on your computer, and it just works.
Yeah.
And nobody talks – I shouldn't say nobody, but most people don't know about it. I mean, it's fabulous. It works
well. And the best part about it is, you know, here's a couple things. Every time I'd go down to watch television, my daughter would have two shows recording at the same time on the DVR, so you can't watch live TV.
Right.
So that eliminates that problem because you got four tuners now. So it the chances of three or four being recorded at the same time are pretty slim.
Right.
The second thing that I can't remember was what was I saying? Four tuners.
My mom would say it must have been a lie.
No, I know. I lost it somewhere, but that's what happens when I try to remember two things at once. But no, it is great, and it really just works nice and easy, and it's integrated into Media Center, and it just works. But yeah, I did want to make one other point, but I lost it.
All right.
So the second thing is I think that's the old model of what we used to talk about as convergence. And I think that's been achieved. So now I think that we're in an era that we're going to talk about the new convergence. And I think it's what we talked about the last time I was kind of an impromptu guest on the show when we were out of town a couple months ago. And that's basically the phone, the tablet, and the laptop. And actually, I think eventually the desktop, too. I think that we're seeing a new era. If you look at the most recent announcement from Asus Computers, they've got, what do they call it, the phone pad, and this was, I think, I was a little bit off when I was talking to you. You said that when I was saying that the handheld cell phone would basically become a tablet. Well, what Asus has done is really the smart thing. They've taken that 4-inch Evo-style phone, and they've created a dock on the back of a 10-inch tablet,
right,
where you just snap in the phone, and now you've got your phone on your tablet, which can do all the functions of a normal tablet, plus you can receive your phone calls on the tablet while you're playing with your tablet. So, yeah, I kind of – and now – it starts to make even more sense that as the computing power and the power consumption decrease and the memory of these devices increase, I think that that's going to be the new model where you have a personal device which is simple to carry in your pocket that you can snap into virtually almost any type of platform to do your computing, to connect to your home network, to do your entertainment, to do your phone calls, your Skype, the whole nine yards, on whatever type of display platform that you want to insert that in. So, yeah, you may put that in a little bit larger tablet. You see the Atrix where you snap it onto what appears to be a laptop platform. And I think eventually it'll get to the point where you just simply plug it into your desktop where you're sitting in front of a large screen monitor, and you basically tap into all your resources that you would normally use in any of those environments. And I think that's where we're headed in the future. And it's probably going to take a few years to get there, but I think that's the model that it seems to be emerging right now.
Gary, let me ask you this question, though. What's the future of the keyboard? So, you know, we basically have a keyboard that was invented 100 years ago.
You know,
that we're still using for the most part, right?
It's interesting you should say that, because I was just thinking the other day, I got another email from Dragon Naturally Speaking, which I've had on my computer for God knows how long, and I never use it.
Yeah.
And I'm sitting here, and I think Google is probably the most advanced in actually integrating usable voice technology into their cell phone platforms, which basically go back to the Google server, interpret the waveform, and then react according to that. So I think that if voice is going to replace the keyboard, I think that's the model that's going to work, where you've got a really high-powered platform that's interpreting it on the other end and connecting it into usable services. But so far, it's been a disappointment that it hasn't become more sophisticated, more user-friendly, and emerged a little bit more quickly than it has.
Well, don't you think people still feel a little bit weird, though? You know, if you look at the Star Trek Next Generation model of Riker, you know, facing up into the sky and saying, computer, you know, and then giving the command. No, I think as humans, we still feel very, very odd. I mean, I've finally gotten over that a little bit in talking into my phone when I'm texting, using voice, you know, the voice commands on the Android. So I'll text it in, say it in. I'll do it in my car when nobody else is around. I will not do that in public. I mean,
right.
I do not know why. That's so stupid.
I think that there's still a little bit of a barrier in usability, in the sense that Like even on the Android, you've got to tap on the little tiny microphone thing, and you really kind of got to hold the mic up to your, you know, and you got to go.
You do that. Like you're showing that on Skype, right?
I would like to talk to my son, you know, so, so I think once the processing power gets to the point where it can actually interpret natural voice and it's more usable in the sense that you don't have to be quite as articulate and quite as careful in the way you do things, I think that barrier will be broken, but I don't think we're quite there yet.
Okay. Yeah, I just I think the barrier, you know, to your discussion going back to a couple months ago when we were talking, the barrier behind a laptop going away is the keyboard, and I still think there are things that we do, and I think of bloggers as one or media writers as one who are still going to need that they want that keyboard, right? That we're still not to the point where they can speak all that in, or it's not comfortable, or I'll be honest with you. When I'm writing, I write better at the keyboard, and I don't write like, you know, paragraph after paragraph after paragraph and then go back and edit it. I write as I go, and part of the magic of the writing, at least for me, is found in the keyboard.
Right. I agree with that. But, you know, when you take the public at large, what percentage of people are actually writers?
True. No, you make a good point there.
And I think that's why the popularity of the iPad type device has just exploded, because I think the majority of people aren't really writers. You know, they're quick texters, but as far as sitting down and actually writing two paragraphs, I think that's a very small percentage of the population.
Yeah, I don't disagree with you on that.
So That kind of leads us to, where is this all going? I mean, if you get this device that you can plug into almost anything, well, what are you going to be actually doing? And I think that, as we've talked about, with the complexity of server technology, SharePoint, SQL Server, Exchange, and Active Directory, and so on, that's just way over the head, not only of the average guy in as a public user, but even some IT professionals have trouble coping with some of the more esoteric stuff. So obviously the trend that Microsoft is trying to sell is to bring everybody into the cloud. So when you take this device and you plug it into whatever platform that you want to use it on, more than likely you're going to connect to a cloud. So the question is going to be, are you going to be connecting to a public cloud or a private cloud? And my recommendation is that you don't plug into the Sony cloud in any time. But, you know, and that's where
they're not even a cloud service provider, and they have those kinds of problems. So I think
you're going to see 90% of the public going to either Azure or Google as their cloud provider to plug in that portable device that connects, you know, the device connects to whatever interface platform you want to use, and then that in turn is connected to your share of the cloud that you're going to communicate with. And for a small percentage of us, and I think it's probably going to be around 5% of us, I mean, we're stuck with our private cloud, and we're kind of happy that we're there.
Are enthusiasts, though, right? I mean, those are the folks who want to build or have that data close to them.
Yep.
Most folks don't. And I'll disagree with you on one point there. I don't think it's Microsoft and Google. I think it's Amazon and Google, and Microsoft plays a distant third. I mean, a very distant third.
Well, I think they play a distant third right now, and I think they know that they're behind the curve, and I think that that's what Windows 8 is going to be all about. I've been doing some reading on some of the technologies, and it looks like they're trying to integrate cross-platform with Windows 8, the phone, the laptop, the tablet, the desktop, the whole shemaz. So I think that they've realized that, and I think that that's what they're going to try and do to gain some more market share back into the marketplace, because they know they're behind.
Yeah. Yeah, so, they've got some work to do. There's a real barrier, it seems to me, to getting to the Microsoft cloud right now. And Google and Amazon have made that fairly easy. And I think,
yes,
you know, you think of Amazon's music offering or cloud music offering, very easy to get your music to the cloud now. Google's always been very easy to get your documents to the cloud. So, and they just have a new tool now where you can just, part of the new offering with Google Apps is they have an uploader tool that you just point it to the files and it brings everything that you own to the cloud.
Yep.
So that we are making that way very, very, very quickly. I know in the enterprise that gets more difficult because we're bound by where data can be stored, not physically. I mean, just physically where it can be stored.
And who can store it and
exactly.
Who can access. Yeah, I know.
So for the private world, that works great. In the enterprise, that is still a horrible mess because I can't trust Google with my enterprise data because it might violate the Patriot Act.
Well, right? And not only that, like I say, I'm still suspect about handing over my data to a third party that I'm going to trust them to provide security for it. I'd much rather monitor my own router and my own, you know, gateway and maintain my own security platforms and.
But you can, right? You can do that.
Yes.
Most people
yes,
can't.
That's correct.
Yeah.
So but I think that's the reality that we're headed towards, and that's basically what I'm trying to highlight. And of course,
yeah.
I think the major factors are going to be connection speed, processing power, and graphics power. So as those continue to progress, you're going to see that model start to take shape. So in the private cloud, what are the recent developments? Well, we in our private cloud, we upgraded to Active Directory and Directory Services, and we moved the DNS onto our server and set up our domain controller and revised SharePoint, which just brings your point home that this ain't for the average guy.
No,
so,
it isn't. It's maybe for a handful of enthusiasts. I mean,
yep.
I've thought about it myself. I probably won't go that far as putting Active Directory in at home. I've wanted to, but I probably won't.
Don't blame you.
Yeah.
So that brings the question: are we on the emergence of the death of the IT guy? I mean, is it going to be to the point where consolidation and standardization into the public cloud is not only for the individual, but it also becomes it starts to invade the corporate sector and take over from the private sector, or the corporate sector having their own private IT department and their own hardware and their own staff, when they can say, hey, you know what, I can just give all this to Microsoft for a lot cheaper than what I'm paying all these guys. And I think that that's a realistic, you know, possibility that people in IT should really be aware of, to make sure that they have skills that are going to be marketable in 10 years, because if that happens, there are going to be a lot of people looking for work.
It's already happening, Gary.
Yeah, I have no doubt.
Although I do think it's a shift in talent, not necessarily an elimination of jobs. So, you know, local shops are always going to need people who can help the average person operate the equipment, whatever that.
Yes.
Whatever that's going to be.
And configuring hardware, yeah, and internal networking.
Access points and,
sure,
and that, you know, the infrastructure to get to the cloud all has to be there. So
yep.
I do see a difference, though, in what you're talking about, and maybe database services. So, you
yep,
know, owning a database, updating a database, those kinds of things, more and more of that could move to the cloud, and you may need less local database folks. Although, I don't know, I just think it's a shift in skill set, not necessarily in bodies.
Let's hope so.
That's my opinion.
So.
Yeah, they just, it's just,
but,
yeah.
But again, it may alter the pay scale in the industry too, because when, you know, I think there's some people making some pretty healthy salaries in database management and security and yada, 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 you know, up at the top of what would you call it, you know, network administration,
sure,
doing Active Directory administration, things like that in large corporations. So if that stuff disappears, yes, you may not lose that many bodies because other people will still need other services, but at what pay scale? You know,
sure,
I don't need to pay somebody $150,000-$200,000 to plug in a network cable to somebody's workstation.
Right. Right.
So I think, again, I mean, those are just points of consideration. Now, the last topic, or one of the last topics that I'm trying to get to quickly, and hopefully we'll
run
right through this, is I think that we're really starting to see the emergence of addressing power consumption. And I got to thank Andrew for turning us on to the Fit PC. That is just a remarkable device. I got to have one. It's just, I got to own one.
It's
cool,
a little,
isn't it? Yeah, it's a little Atom-powered PC that's about the size, literally, it's about the size of a pack of cigarettes.
Yeah.
It's got two gigabit E Ethernet ports on the back of it. It's got a 2 gigahertz Atom inside. It can have with 2 gigabits of memory. I mean, and it consumes like 5 watts of power. It's like, you got to be kidding me. So I did some more reading and some more research. Intel just announced this Ultrabook concept where they're going to be looking at bringing the laptop down under 20 watts. And we're looking at new Atoms that are going to operate in a range of 800 milliwatts to 8 watts.
Wow.
So as these CPUs and these platforms that are really low power consumption but still have some horsepower start to emerge, you're going to start seeing a reconfiguration of the networks where you're using these low power platforms and just, you know, pasting them on the back of the monitor and plugging in the keyboard. And like I say, the power savings alone are going to pay for these devices over time, and getting rid of these monster boxes alongside everybody's desk, and then shifting all the storage to a central server. So I think that that model is going to move forward. And I think that as SSDs become more affordable, I think the death of the hard disk on the workstation is inevitable. It's only a matter of time.
Yeah, about 10 years, you think? I mean,
no,
longer
I don't,
than that?
No. Not
quicker than that.
Near that long. Oh, yeah. I think 5 years or less.
All right.
I think within 5 years, you won't be buying any computer with a spinning disk in it. All spinning disks will be on a server of some kind.
Okay.
Yeah, without a doubt. It technology.
Well, you're saying at the workstation level, SSD everywhere.
Yes.
Okay.
Absolutely. Right. I think within 5 years you won't be able to buy a hard disk in a consumer device that you're going to use to take home in a laptop or a desk.
Yeah.
And again, that's all just to give you connection to either the public cloud, where you store the bulk of your data. Because once you move to an SSD device with the speed and the lower power consumption, now because your SSD is smaller in its storage capacity, you offload all your storage onto the cloud.
Right.
And I think that's where, you know, you look 5 years down the road. I mean, that's definitely, I think, where we're headed.
Yeah, I don't disagree. And I think we don't fix our battery issues with better batteries. We fix it with lower consuming equipment, right? I mean, batteries will continue to get better, but not at the rate that we're dropping energy consumption on our equipment.
Yep, they're talking. Yeah. They're talking about 10 to 12 hours on this Ultrabook.
Yeah.
And
that's very, very manageable for the average person.
Yeah,
that's
and
a whole day, right? You know, use it all day, plug it in at night.
Yeah. Absolutely. Christian's netbook, when we first bought it, he would get 10 hours on it.
Yeah.
You know, the battery's getting a little old, been recycled a few times, so it's starting to drop. But I think, Chris, do you still get like about 8 hours on a full charge?
Yeah, it's like 6 to 7.
6 to 7, depending on the environment. But yeah, I think that's where we're headed. So
that's good stuff.
Just my 2 cents worth.
No, some good. I think there's some really good points in that, especially as we look forward to what is out there. And I'm pretty excited. I'm with you. I'm pretty excited about these ultra low power. Andrew, you showed me that same link for that Fit PC, and that would make
awesome.
A perfect HT PC for me.
Oh, also, I did read on their forums that they're coming out with the PC3 probably at the end of summer, which will have the AMD low power CPU in it.
Yeah,
see, that's what I'm waiting for.
Yeah, maybe a little bit more power, but maybe a little faster and maybe a little bit better. Yeah, I kind of looked at it, and I'm not so sure that the PC2 would have enough graphics power for Blu-ray quality video. I'm not sure.
Okay.
So
oh, good point.
And I'd hate to spend $500 to find out. So.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah. Well, and I've seen some of those, and they're not this brand, but I've seen some other brands on Newegg that are same size, little boxes, size of a deck of cards, maybe a little bit bigger than that, but not much. Maybe it's thick of a ham sandwich.
Yeah.
At Arby's.
The classic net top. And you can buy a base amount, slap it on the back of the monitor. Nobody even knows it's there.
Right. Right. Well, guys, we've gone a little bit long, and but I appreciate the content. I appreciate you guys. The guests listening probably didn't know, but I had to step out for a few minutes. My family came in, and I had to jump out, and you guys did a great job of keeping the podcast going. A whole host of audio problems tonight, so if you've made it this far in the podcast, thank you for getting through that, and certainly it seems like each week we do find, for whatever reason, the Skype gods, the audio gods were not with us this evening, but we made it to the end of it. Andrew, thanks for coming in and getting up early for
fun.
Us.
I love it.
And now you're off to your Friday, which is always, I'm always jealous that you're a day ahead and that you get to the weekend before we do. Christian, thanks for making it all work there at the Johnson household.
Thanks, guys.
Tonight, and Christian's down in the basement in his dad's place with the camera stuck in his pocket as he's for his audio. That's great. Gary, thanks for joining us this evening as well and being the guest on the show. We'll get you scheduled for the next one here as we get into summer, and we'll get you back on, and you can update the big picture. I like that. Maybe that'll be your segment going on from here on out. We'll call it Gary's Big Picture. I like that.
Thanks for having me, guys. I had a lot of fun.
All right. I appreciate you coming out. And if you want to email the podcast again, podcast@theaverageguy.tv. We've been getting a couple emails each week, so I appreciate that feedback. You can find us on Facebook just by searching for The Average Guy Network, and follow me on Twitter @JayCollison. The rest of our Twitter stuff is out there, and you can that both Christian and Andrew's Twitter account is out there. Thanks, guys. Have a great evening, and we'll do it all again next week.
Take care, everyone.
Bye, guys.
All right.
Good night.
Good night.